This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind, but HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkSpotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Welcome to episode 165 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today, welcome Steve Peterson from such bands as Cursive, The White Octave, Slow Down Virginia, and Criteria. The boys in Criteria, after 15 years, have a new album entitled Years, coming out on 15 Passenger Records next month. And Steve was kind enough to spend some time with Washed Up to talk about it. If you're listening to this in the future, it is out now on streaming services. In this episode, we have to dive into how Steve met Tim and Matt from Cursive, what the glue was behind the Omaha scene, and how that led to Saddle Creek Records starting up. We also discuss how he divides up work and play, and how that was achieved while attending law school at Duke. We try and touch on every part of Steve's career, and most of all, talk about the new Criteria record. With that said, you're about to hear a little taste of that album with a song called Agitate Resuscitate. Fun fact, it's Steve's first third album as a musician. That is reason enough to celebrate, and you'll learn why later on in the podcast. Thank you all the Patreon supporters out there. This podcast is made with love from the help of your contributions every single month that goes toward the upkeep of the website, servers, and the like. If you want to support too, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. This is episode 165 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Steve Peterson for Cursive, The White Octave, Slow Down Virginia, and Criteria.
My earliest musical memories were probably listening to like Peter, Paul, and Mary records that my parents were big Peter, Paul, and Mary fans, and that would have been, gosh, I don't know how old I was, but I just remember, I vividly remember that music very early on in my life.
Did you start to feel like, wow, there's got to be more out there?
Not at the point of Peter, Paul, and Mary. I think for me, I had the good fortune of having an older brother, and he was kind of my gateway into cool music, which probably started in, I don't know, maybe fifth grade. So I was probably 10 years old. And my brother was getting into bands like Husker Du and R.E.M. and Led Zeppelin and The Clash and The Who. And so those were that was my first group of bands that I would listen to because that's what my brother was listening to. So that was really the moment where I was like, wow, music can be really cool. Like, this is really cool music. And then I started to kind of branch out and find my own bands. I got really into the band that actually inspired me to get a guitar was this band called Love and Rockets. They kind of rose from the ashes of Bauhaus. It's kind of like Bauhaus minus Peter Murphy. And they had this song called No New Tale to Tell. And I just thought the opening, which is just like basically an acoustic guitar line, was just so cool that I had to learn it. And I had been taking piano. At this point, I'm, 14 years old. So I've moved a little forward in the life of Steve. But by the time I was 14, I had sort of discovered, Love and Rockets and Bauhaus and They Might Be Giants, like the album Lincoln by They Might Be Giants. I was just a huge fan of that record. Like Life's Rich Pageant and Fables of the Reconstruction by R.E.M. and this band called Dramarama. And then like Husker Du and, kind of a couple other bands that just really got me excited about music. So, that's kind of how it started. And Love and Rockets was kind of the band that got me interested in learning to play the guitar.
And so you started with piano and then, you saw the guitar and you realized like, this is going to be a lot more fun.
Oh yeah. It was totally my jam. Almost immediately. I think I took 4 or 5 years of piano lessons and really made no progress musically. Within 2 weeks of owning a guitar, I was a more competent guitar player than I was a piano player. And I never, and I'm sure there was probably some foundational work that the piano provided that allowed me to sort of accelerate. But I never took any lessons and just kind of, I learned that Love and Rockets song, but I didn't even learn the whole song. Like I never spent a lot of time learning other people's music. I just immediately started kind of writing my own.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're in a cover band or you're going to play a few songs through and then you start playing your own stuff.
I went the opposite direction. I was writing my own. I mean, I don't even know if, I guess you could call them songs, but I was writing my own music from the start and eventually did actually get into a band called the March Hares. And I don't know if you've ever spoken with any of the cursive guys like Tim or Matt.
I have spoken with Tim.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the March Hares was Tim Kasher, who sings and plays guitar in cursive, and Matt McGinn, who plays bass, and me, and this guy named Jim Rubino, who actually sang in the band, and a guy named Casey Caniglia, who played drums. And that was kind of the first band that I had gotten into, was with Matt and Tim. And we played like probably 60% originals and then 40% covers. And we would like play like all the little high school dances around town and, occasionally get like a gig at a bar, which is like a really big deal when you're 15 or 16, and you're like hanging out at a bar.
How did you meet those guys?
I met, I remember the first time I met Tim. I was at a Catholic youth soccer tournament in Okoboji, Iowa. and I must have been in seventh grade, and Tim was in eighth grade. He was a year ahead of me. We went to different Catholic grade schools.
Mm-hmm.
I went to St. Robert's, he went to St. Pius. But I just remember, like, at the beginning of this tournament, there's like an opening ceremony. Like, they make a big deal out of it, and all these little, Catholic school boys and girls are like marching around this track for the parents to kind of begin the opening ceremonies, like a mini Olympics. And I just remember walking around the track with my soccer team. And then out of nowhere, this kid who had like taken his shirt, like the front of his shirt, and had lifted it up and like put it behind his head. So like he was still wearing the shirt,
mm-hmm.
but it was like exposing his chest, was like walking around, like almost kind of like Quasimodo, and just kind of like growling, and just acting like a total jackass. And that was my introduction to Tim. just a completely free-spirited, unhinged, bizarre young man. I met Matt the next year. So when I was in eighth grade, I met Matt. He went to a different Catholic grade school too. He and Tim grew up like down the street from each other. So they were thick as thieves in grade school. And also like the youngest, they both came from families with a lot of older siblings, and they were kind of the trailers. Like they were both, I think maybe 5 or 10 years younger than their next youngest sibling. So they were kind of, So they just had a lot in common. I met Matt at a high school party, when I was in eighth grade, which was, unusual. I think at that time for both of us to have been at a party. And I just thought he was like the coolest dude. Like he had, these really sweet Adidas Stan Smith tennis shoes that I just thought were so cool. Like he was totally styling. And then we've all wound up going to the same, high school together, and they had started a band almost straight away in high school. And I had yet to pick up, an instrument. And so about, I think kind of halfway through my sophomore year, they asked me to join their band March Hares. And I did.
What music did you guys connect on? Like, did you mention your Husker Du or Dramarama? Were they also telling you about stuff that you'd never heard? Because I think it's one thing to mention too, from a small town, like it's sometimes really hard to find out about stuff.
Absolutely, dude. And we're talking about like 1990, you know, when things were not accessible, and we did not have a college radio station. So it was not easy to discover bands. But they introduced me to the Pixies.
No shit.
Which was like a real revelation for me. And then also at that time we were really into this band, like at the early March Hares time, we were like really into Toad the Wet Sprocket. Do you remember that band?
Of course I remember them, yeah.
Yeah, so like all of these, you know, so just all of these kind of seemingly contradictory influences. You've got sort of these like really kind of angular, aggressive rock of the Pixies with sort of these sensitive, traditionally structured indie pop, like Toad the Wet Sprocket, we're all kind of coming together as we were starting to write our own music.
I wish I could watch them tell you about the Pixies for the first time again, because I bet your like right. Synapses were probably going insane.
Oh yeah, it blew my mind. Like at first, I was really almost kind of scared of it.
Right.
I'm trying to remember what.
That's interesting. I've never thought about that being scared. You're right.
But it was just like, it was like Black Francis was just like screaming at me. And you know, there is some screaming in Husker Du, but the way that Black Francis screamed was like it was like he was murdering someone or he was being murdered. And there was just something way more visceral and immediate about what he was doing. That really like freaked me out, but in a really good way. You know, March Hares kind of, I should add, there was a record store in Omaha. There were a couple of record stores in Omaha, kind of early on. One was Homer's, but the one that really kind of catered to sort of the underground indie scene was this, record store called the Antiquarium, which was run by a gentleman named David Sink, who has since died. But he was kind of like the guru of what you should be listening to. He was just this hyper intelligent, impossibly thin older man who, curatorial and, a completist when it came to all different styles of music, from jazz to folk to punk, and just knew more about music than any of us did. And so we would just go down there and hang out with him, and he would just play records for us, and we'd find out about new bands.
Do you remember any?
Oh, sure. So, like, that was the first time I had ever heard this band called Brainiac, which is kind of having a little bit of a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Again, their singer died a long time ago, but I think there was a documentary coming out about the band. And finding out about Brainiac was another band that kind of had the same effect as the Pixies, where it was almost like unsettling how visceral the music was. But it was so good. And they came to Omaha quite a bit. You know, they were from Dayton, so we were kind of, you know, we were in the Midwest. So they made it through town a bunch of times. And every time they came through town, they absolutely destroyed live. Like, they were the best live band I'd ever heard in my life. In fact, there was one night, it was just so perfect. They were playing at this club called the Cog Factory. And during the middle of their set, the tornado sirens went off in the city. And when the tornado sirens go off in Nebraska, like, it's legit. Like, your life is, you need to address the risk. So, like, we all, like, you know, the sirens go off and everyone in the club, like, barrels out of this super dingy club into, like, this car mechanic shop that was next door to the club, and for whatever reason we thought was more fortified, and kind of waited out this tornado so we could go back in and rock out to Brainiac after the tornado left town. But just the whole idea that as Brainiac rolls into town, a tornado comes with them just made so much sense to me.
I love that.
As a teenage boy, just like, my God, these guys are a supernatural force.
Yeah, you were up all night that night. You couldn't go to sleep.
Yes, I was. I was so amped up. So, and then like, what other bands? Like, there were just these bands that came to Omaha that I think were surprised that there was this, like, burgeoning little music scene with kind of what would eventually become sort of the Saddle Creek Records community. So, like, Spoon came through town. I remember seeing Spoon, and it was just me and Connor from Bright Eyes. Like, we were the only two people there.
Wow.
And they wound up staying at my apartment that I was living in at the time. And then the next time they came through town, it was like, then there was 50 people. And the next time they came through town, it was like 300. And then this band called The Wrens, who were from Secaucus, just had a really special kind of place in Omaha's music scene's heart. Like, they played, they would make trips. They would, you know, normally their tour would stop in Chicago, but they would make the extra 8-hour drive to Omaha because the shows were so good. Cause there were just all these kids who had found out about their records through this, an aquarium, this record store, Dave Sink, who just had exposed this whole community of young music nuts to these great bands.
That's, I mean, like you mentioned, this sort of setting up this sort of, you know, the Saddle Creek community and, like, finding those towns that have those record stores or those radio stations to pass on this information. And like you said, it does make a difference. Like,
yeah. Oh, it was huge.
Yeah. That's what
created the ecosystem.
What? Yeah. So
having
that record store was the apex of that.
Oh, totally. For a good long while, it was the source, because we did not have college radio. And, you know, unless you were, like, had a subscription to CMJ,
right?
You know, you were not, it was really difficult to find out about sort of the new bands. And then when, you know, I got old enough to realize that, gosh, some of these bands actually go on tour, like, just even learning that the band that you heard on the record or on the cassette was going to come to your town and play those songs live in front of you. you know, kind of, you know, you think about that, like, sort of visceral reaction that you have just to hearing the music on a cassette tape.
Mm-hmm.
Like, imagine what it's like when it's, like, being performed, you know, 3 feet in front of you. So it was, and still is, like, I'm just amped up talking about it. Like, it was such an energizing experience for me to to see these bands perform these songs that I never, I mean, there were probably, I'm sure there were moments when I was younger where I just didn't even think I would get to have that kind of experience with that band. So yeah, it was very formative.
Why was that town or that city so receptive to it? Because you might have a great record store and no one goes to it or no one cares. Why was it David? Was it that people were starving for it? Like, what were the other ingredients for that?
That's a good question. I mean, I think a part of it is luck. Part of it is that you had, I mean, and there was a generation of local musicians. I haven't even talked about the local component of this, but there was a generation of older local musicians and older bands that came before us that kind of laid the groundwork for the local music scene. But fundamentally, like Omaha in the 1980s and 1990s, if you're a teenager, like there was not a lot going on. Like, it's a great place to grow up as a small child, and it's a great place to raise a family. But the in-between, there really wasn't a lot to offer, like, teenage kids and even college-age kids. So it was kind of slim pickings. And I think by default, people turned to music, to listening to it, to making it, because there wasn't a lot else to do. And it was a great outlet, you know, to just kind of, and to create. The other thing about Omaha is it is very community focused. There's a real and strong sense of community. And so just like in the culture, in, you know, in being neighborly, in like lots of people like back day would join like lodges and be a part of like small community groups where you practiced being in a community. And that was like part of your experience of living, was having these smaller communities that you engaged in some sort of activity with. And so that sense of community was transferred into the music scene, where like we had a mayor. There was a mayor of Saddle Creek.
Really?
When Saddle Creek was just forming, like,
what years were that again?
Oh gosh, this would have been 94, 95, I think.
94, 95 sounds right.
Yeah. And we were, you know, no one cared about our bands. No one wanted to put out our records. And so we did it ourselves, and built up this, you know, this community of musicians, and that, you know, we had promoters, we had musicians, and then eventually we had our own record label, and we just did it all ourselves. And I'm, you know, so there's Midwestern work ethic, and there's this really strong sense of community that you like support each other and you help each other out.
Right. And I think that piece of it, is, I mean, that does take work. That doesn't happen instantly. Yeah. It doesn't happen with opening up a website and, or doing one show and thinking it'll happen. Like, this happens over time and you need a lot of people. It can't just be you, Steve, or you and Matt or Tam. Like, if it was just you three, Spoon wouldn't have come back if it was just three.
That's right. Yeah. We wouldn't be talking if it was just three. I wouldn't have had the great, you know, life adventure that I've had because of music if it was three. So, that strength of community, I think played a really big role. And then for whatever reason, there's definitely some luck and randomness that you would have, someone like Connor and someone like Todd Beckley from The Faint and someone like Tim from Cursive, and countless others. But those were kind of the big three at the time who were just really writing great music. And great music that didn't sound anything like the other person's music. So you had these three, with The Faint, with Bright Eyes, and with Cursive, these three very distinct bands. But like fundamentally, the craft, like the song writing and the craftsmanship were really strong. And just for all of them to not only, you know, be friends, but to be in the same city and to be basically in the same generation of musicians, and to sort of all come up together was just, that's the luck part.
You're right. Yeah, having all those at the same time.
Yeah.
And also finding special. Yeah, but also the I think timing too on the music, because people were really starting to look for more things, and that time period and a label like that, I think people notice that, oh wow, look at all these different things. It isn't just one sound. That was also probably a positive.
We were diversified, Tom.
Your 401k and your IRA and everything else.
That's right, man. Yeah, we made some good investments. You know what? We hedged against bad times. It all worked out.
Guy, it's all about diversifying, all right?
Yeah. It is amazing, though. Like, I think about it, you know, we're all much older now, that, you know, Tim does this for a living. This is his career is as a songwriter, and he stays very busy and he's very active. And same with Connor, and same with Todd. Like Todd, I think Todd's making hats now too. It sounds silly, but he's like a haberdasher. Like he has a custom hat company.
Where?
I think it's called Recapitate. Yeah. Clever. And the hats are like really cool. If I didn't have such a little bean, tiny little head, I would probably buy one of his hats, but hats and I don't work out well together. But yeah, they're still doing, you know, into their mid 40s, making music for a living. And doing it their way is really, again, just kind of crazy that after all this time and being from Omaha,
right.
Although I don't think really any of them, none of them really reside. I got Connor. Actually, Connor doesn't live too far. We live about 6 blocks from each other now. But Tim, I think, lives most of his time in Los Angeles, and Todd moved to, I think, Joshua Tree.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. A little desert.
Yeah. Nicer weather. It's like 14 degrees in Omaha right now with snow on the ground. So they're probably, their feet are not cold like mine.
During that, you know, after the March Hares, and you had another little band for a second, right? Smash Mouth.
Yes. Not that Smash Mouth.
Yes, no, I know, the indie rock band Smash Mouth, yeah.
Yeah, so that was me and Ted Stevens, who plays guitar in Cursive, and when I went away for school, he replaced me in Cursive, and this guy named Bart Volkmer. Bart played bass in Smash Mouth, and he is now the general counsel of Dropbox.
Wow.
Yeah. Local boy made good. And a wonderful guy. And I get to see him. I take trips out to San Francisco on a semi-regular basis, so I get to see him out there. So yeah, that was Smash Mouth. And we made two records. I think only one of them got released. The other one is
in the vault.
I think it's out there. I don't know where. I have not really looked into it, but I know people have gotten a hold of it, which is great. So it's somewhere out there. I don't know that I have a copy, but I know it's out there.
Got it. And then that turned into Slow Down Virginia, correct? And that was in the early 90s.
Well, so actually what happened is you're real close here. This is good. This is impressive, Tom. So March Hares became Slow Down Virginia.
Oh, right.
Right. And then Smash Mouth and Slow Down Virginia became Cursive. So the drummer for Smash Mouth was a guy named Clint Schnazzy. In fact, that's still his name. His name is Clint Schnazzy. And Clint and I from Smash Mouth went and joined basically myself. I was in Slow Down at the time. Matt McGinn and Tim Kasher from Slow Down to form Cursive. I could not have made that any less clear. I apologize.
I understand. Everyone else understands. Or they're yelling at me for not remembering a timeline, which is fine because I'm not perfect. I mean, especially this era of the one, you know, the Curse of Records that you did, the Such Blinding Stars and the Storms of Early Summer. You know, I remember bugging Tim during our podcast interview and said, if you ever do reissues, like, let me know. Those are like super important to me, and ended up, you know, doing stuff for it. But I think those records, with you, are some of my favorite songs. I mean, Cursive has such a long, career. But it's fun to hear that because I still feel 97. I can still feel 98 when I listen to it. And it has, it's just this, it's angular, it's aggressive, it was emotional. And I mean, is there anything that you remember from those, you know, first couple records that...
Such Blinding Stars for Starving Eyes was like us just, there was something really sludgy about it that I didn't love. Like the dynamics were great and the angst was great. But on Storms, it became apparent to me that like Tim and the band was really onto something in terms of developing a really unique sound and sort of the interplay between the guitars and the drums and bringing this very disciplined or angular focus to the music, kind of squeezing out all the sludginess and really doing something that was, disciplined is the word I like to use, but I think angular is also a good word, but there was just this discipline to the music. That kind of, I thought was just really, really cool. And just kind of fit with sort of my approach to the guitar, which was very kind of percussive and riff based and, you know, sort of finding a series of notes and repeating them. it was clear that like, the band had really hit on something. With Domestika and even with the EP that came out, before Domestika, they kind of took it to a whole nother level of just sort of bringing in this, really thematic and anthemic, component to that mix that just made it really special.
For you, did you feel the emo tag for those first two records? Did you feel people attaching it to it?
Probably. I didn't, I think back then it had not yet become like such a toxic word.
No.
And that it really just, when, like back then when someone said emo, I was like, yeah, man, like Fugazi, like mm-hmm. Fugazi was an emo band for me. Like that's what I thought of as emo music. And like Fugazi is untouchable. They are unassailable. They are one of the greatest bands of all time. So it just didn't have that, that stink, and that taint, and that sort of negative, saccharine-y, mm-hmm. Whiny connotation that
permeates today.
That it has now. Yeah. But yeah, we were definitely an emo band. For better or for worse.
Yeah. I remember getting the records from Sunday Service through AAM. Getting those in college and I was in college from 96 to 2000 and getting those records and getting them. I think it turned me on to Saddle Creek. It turned me on to that area of the country because I hadn't, being from the East Coast, I didn't know this stuff was going on. So you mentioned earlier just about, you know, sort of the perfect ingredients. It really was an amazing moment to have you guys all meet and all do your own thing and all be supportive. And I think that's the only way that it works. And
yeah,
for you to, you know, still be in touch with everybody. I mean, just all that is kind of, amazing in itself and should be sort of thought about more.
It is special. And I am Tom, I'm very much on the outskirts of it now just because of my, I'm not a full-time musician. Mm-hmm. I have a day job. I have three kids and a wife, and that is really my life.
Yeah.
Is the work that I do and my family. So I don't stay out late anymore like my old rock cronies do. I just can't hang with them. But the fact that I can, you know, that that Matt and Tim were passionate about putting out a Criteria record at this phase of, you know, Criteria's like life cycle, which is a strange thing in and of itself, and that, you know, they're excited about it, really means a lot to me that they care, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because we have such a long history, and when we see each other, you know, there's no, it's just like 1997.
I wanted to mention White Octave before we get to Criteria real quick. I definitely sure. saw you at the Cradle as White Octave.
Oh, nice.
I went to Elon, down the road.
Oh, no way.
And yeah. So I definitely saw you guys. I mean, it was probably at Go 4 or Cradle. Oh, or,
I love that club. Which was so much fun.
Go was really fun.
Yeah.
What happened?
That was a cool. I don't know, dude. I don't know.
I feel like someone closed it down or something. That club, yeah. And 533 Uprising in Winston-Salem were my two favorites.
There's this club right kind of on the main strip, just down from Cat's Cradle, called the Local 506.
Yes.
Which was a really great club in Chapel Hill. In fact, the White Octave is getting back together to play the Cat's Cradle's 50th birthday party.
That's so fucking rad. And yeah. A friend that's from down there was like, "So you coming?" Because he showed me the bands, and I was like, "Shit, that's so cool." God bless the Cradle, man.
I know. What an institution! It's incredible that it's been around for 50 years. And you know, I mean, it's kind of like the same thing about this antiquarium, this record store. Like the Cat's Cradle is, you know, so critical to the ecosystem for music in Chapel Hill, and part of what sustained that music scene for so long was to have such a great venue for local acts and for local acts to open for great touring acts, and all that stuff contributes to the health of the scene.
That's what I loved, like going to those shows, like if it was whatever band, like there'd be the opener and everyone would be there. It'd be like jammed and you're like, this is the opener band. Like it made me again happy that this city could, you know, or the area could do that. Cause it was like, it was almost for a different purpose.
Yep.
That's
community,
cool.
Baby.
Yeah. So when you were in school, how were you doing the White Octave at the same time and being able to do that in the early 2000s? Like, was it just on breaks? Like, what was the...
Well, my answer is going to be none of it very well. but the band was a full-time thing. I mean, we put out two records. We toured. And, you know, the nice thing about the school I went to is there was no... They didn't take attendance. It's not a nice thing. But one of the components of the school I went to, that you were not required to be in class.
Wow.
And that you were essentially graded on one exam at the end of the semester. So as long as you could show up and take the test, answer the questions, in the way that the professor was looking for you to answer them, you were fine. So that was kind of the strategy I took for most of school, was just to kind of, study for the test and take the test and hope that I do well enough to not, be throwing away all the money that I borrowed to get that education.
Wow. Did you like, was it like, I got to finish this test because I got to leave, I got to go on the road?
Like, I need... yeah. In fact, the day after I graduated from Duke, I went on tour. So it was just kind of like, it's a bit of a soundbite, but that, I mean, that kind of crystallizes sort of my experience there. Was I knew if I could go to a really good, like reputable school, that I, as long as I was average, I didn't need to be exceptional at right. Duke to get a good job. And that would free up my time to go and be in a band. It was the reason I went to Duke, because I knew there was a good music scene. I knew that I could find musicians. I had already kind of been through town before, and there was an Omaha guy named Matt Oberst, Connor's older brother, who was living there and, you know, had offered to connect me with musicians. So I knew I could do it there and still do school and, you know, make it work well enough.
That's amazing.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Well, no, it's just, again, being able to have the foresight to, you know, not pick a random just for the school, or realize that there were two things that you were trying to do, and to find a place that fit both of those was, I think, people it sometimes always, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. That's what works for me in undergraduate. Like I was very intensely engaged in undergraduate school and also intensely engaged in music, and sort of having both sort of things going on at the same time, was in a lot of ways like better for me, because I felt like I, was exercising both sides of my brain, which made the other side better. So I felt like I was a better student because I would, you know, after class, I would go and write music and create music with people. And then, I was a better musician because of the discipline that I brought to studying and figuring out how to excel at school. So they always went hand in hand for me, and it just would have been weird. Like even after law school, when I started working as a lawyer, just continuing to try and find that balance, and it got harder. I eventually left. I was working at a law firm, and I left the law firm for a couple of years so I could tour, because it just became kind of impossible to really serve the firm and the clients of the firm while being a traveling musician. But I always tried to find that balance between doing sort of, whether it was academics or my job, and music.
And then for you to take that time off, you were confident in yourself to be like, I can get another job.
Apparently so. I think if you had asked my parents at the time, the wisdom of that decision, they would probably have a different answer. But it all worked out, Tom. It all worked out. So we try not to think too deeply about those decisions, but it was a great adventure.
So after White Octave, they left North Carolina, and you're doing this, you were starting the Criteria, right? And that's, when did that start again? That was 2002, 2003, right?
Yeah, right. So like the record, I think, came out in maybe spring or summer of 2003, I think.
Yeah. On Initial Records.
Andy Rich of Initial Records, Andy Rich, who's just one of the sweetest guys you'll ever meet, was the owner founder of Initial Records, and is now, I think, I can't remember which casino he works for, but he runs like one of the premier like poker rooms in the country. Like he is like the director of poker at like the Horseshoe, or you know, just some of the Bellagio, I can't remember what it
in Vegas.
Yes, Yeah. And he was like, he's always been kind of a, even when he was at the record label, like he would go and play, he'd enter poker tournaments to raise money to put out records. Like that's how he, I mean, that's how he raised money. He would go and with his poker earnings, he would invest that money into the label.
I loved Initial Records. So I always gave them a shot whenever they had a record coming out. Cause it was like,
oh, you're a good man. Yeah, Andy was a great guy, and the guys that worked at that label were all just really wonderful, wonderful people. But yeah, so Initial, Andy, you know, he had put out the White Octave, the second White Octave record.
Menergy.
Menergy. And was open to putting out the Criteria record. And so, yeah, he put it out. And... you know, yeah, the songs I had moved back to Omaha and I was living in Matt McGinn's basement. He kind of set me up. Like I was like, I think it was like the bedroom I was in, like had like the boiler or the furnace.
Right.
Too. It was not glamorous. But he gave me a place to stay while I looked for a house and kind of got settled back into Omaha. And I wrote most of the record in his basement.
Wow.
Yeah. While I was, you know, kind of readjusting to being back in Omaha and looking for a place to live.
And a couple songs on the, is it En-Garde? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. Okay. En-Garde.
En-Garde. Oh yeah. En-Garde.
It's like
Jeez.
That fencing, the fencing.
Right.
En-Garde.
En-Garde. I guess the two songs that stick out, and I think for a lot of people, is The Coincidence and Me on Your Front Porch. Anything specifically about those two you want to, I think worth mentioning?
sure. So, they are about, an old girlfriend, from law school who is a wonderful woman and just a really cool lady, who now lives in Seattle. And, they're kind of interesting bookends to the relationship. Me on Your Front Porch is about the beginning of the relationship. Which started kind of the second year of law school at Duke. She was a law student at Duke too. And sort of the oddballs of our class kind of sifted to the bottom throughout the first year. Like we all kind of found each other because we weren't like the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we all moved into a house together. And, I remember and Amy is her name, had agreed to move into this house. And that was just really frightening and exciting for me because I had a major crush on her. And, the first day back for second year of law school, I show up, I think I had actually just come off tour, with the White Octave, and I show up at this house that we're renting and Amy is on the front porch. And it's just me and her, like we don't have a key to the house and we're just hanging out on the front porch. And like that night, I kind of had the feeling that, you know what, this might just deteriorate into a relationship exactly how I envisioned it. So, and it did, and it was great. She's super cool. And then The Coincidence is kind of about the end of the relationship. And that's sort of this coincidence of us living in the same house and all these things have sort of, come to an end and now it's time to say goodbye.
I like that.
Yeah, is that good?
Yeah, that's
good.
Great.
That is probably the only time I've explained those two songs in that detail, but you asked
a
really good question because those two songs just happen to be connected in that way.
Well,
nice
you know,
job,
look,
Tom.
Look, I mean, this isn't my first rodeo, okay?
I've done this before.
So, I guess for people that maybe haven't listened or maybe they know Cursive or maybe they don't know, you know, White Octave, like when I first heard Criteria, which I was working at labels in New York and I probably, you know, got it from Initial and just it's like the riff is I don't know. I feel like there's somebody like holding it up and showing it during the song. Does that make sense? Like the riff is there and you need to acknowledge it.
Embrace the riff.
Yeah.
We are not background music.
Right.
You don't put us on at like a bar mitzvah and think that you're going to be able to talk over it.
No.
Yeah, it's very in your face. I mean, this gets back to like what we were talking about earlier about just like having this really visceral reaction to the Pixies or to Brainiac. Like that was just like embedded in me as like, that's a really cool quality in a band in music is to like, you kind of have no choice but to sort of be captured by it sonically.
Right.
And so I like finding that moment where you can really assail someone with just a ton of riffage and rock.
Well, as you said earlier about wanting to find a guitar to play that song from Dramarama,
Love and Rockets.
Love and Rockets.
The
same kind of thing where, you know, I'm hearing Prevent the World or I'm hearing, you know, a white octave song and it's like, I want to figure out how to play that riff. And I was a guitar player being like this. It had that same effect where that's what I meant about the riff was in front. It's almost like it had it like tabbed out, but you were hearing it.
Totally.
Where again, that was that just from those Pixies days or was there other influences or other thoughts around like the construction of the song?
So virtually every Criteria song is an effort to rip off Quicksand and Chavez.
Wow.
Shout
out to Wally. Like those,
oh God, Walter. He's so good at what he does.
So good. Doing Gorilla Biscuits, still doing like all those other like
bless his heart. I mean and Quicksand is still playing shows too. Put out a record 2 years ago?
Yep.
I mean that like sort of post hardcore art rock, like heavy art rock scene was really influential from like the riff standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And like Walter from a vocal standpoint, like I am not a good singer. And not that Walter is a bad singer, but like his sort of tonality, sort of that kind of piercing angular mid range is kind of my sweet spot too. They were a huge influence on me.
That's amazing. I actually can totally hear that now. Like the mid. Oh wow. That I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
Wally, you motherfucker. You landmine spring motherfucker.
That's so funny you said that because I was just my son, I have an 8-year-old son, I have 3 boys, and my oldest is 8, and we were just kind of sitting at the dinner table, just the two of us. I got home late and I was eating my dinner and he had found out that dad's music is on Alexa.
Oh.
And so he was playing me all these, oh my gosh, now my Alexa's listening to me. I shouldn't have said that. I'm surrounded by Alexas. But he just thought it was really cool that like all of dad's bands were on this tube. And he asked me like, what's your favorite song? And I told the tube to play Landmine Spring. Not that it was necessarily my favorite song, but that was the song that came to mind.
Wow.
First. And I would always listen to that song before I would take an exam.
Really?
Like that was, yeah.
Would that be like, I'm going to ace this motherfucker. Give me an MI string.
Exactly. It was like it was my hype song. And then I would listen to Obladi Oblada after the test was over to relieve myself of any illusion that I had just aced the test. I was like, life goes on.
I can see you on the campus doing that. Like I've been on Duke campus enough. I can be like, nope, there's that. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there's Steve.
Yeah. Maybe he passed. Who knows?
I just forgot to ask you about this. Did you ever go to any Duke Coffee House shows?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you play there?
Saw Cave In. Yeah, we played there. We played there with, well, we played there with Cave In. I saw Cave In without us and with us. Who else did I see there? Man, I probably saw a dozen shows there. Probably played there maybe two or three times.
Okay. So I was trying to think if I had seen you there or seen one of your bands, because that a friend that used to book it, I still talk to. This guy Jason.
Oh, no way.
And we'll randomly catch up about, you know, shows or something. But I thought that was also a really special spot.
That was. That was a cool club, man.
I mean, it was campus.
Yeah, which was weird because, like, Duke's not like a real, like, hip.
No.
It's not, you know, UNC Chapel Hill.
No.
It's the safety school for all the kids who didn't get into Princeton and Harvard. you know, so they kind of have a chip on their shoulder. And anyway, it just isn't the kind of place you would think would have a really great club. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The coffee house was sweet.
It's
the
just,
stage is a little tall.
It was tall.
Tall for my taste.
Yeah, like if you fell off of that, that's bad news.
You will feel it in the morning.
There is a VHS tape of my band playing at the Duke Coffee House. No one will see it, but there is a VHS tape.
What band were you in?
You would have never heard of us. We were.
Was this when you were at Elon?
Yeah, was this when I was at Elon? We had a band called what the hell were we called? Twisted Kites.
Twisted Kites.
You're welcome. You're welcome. No, it was fun. We played on campus a lot and played, like, you know, if we opened up for some bands once in a while on mostly my senior year, like 99 or 2000. But we sounded like Jay June, Texas is the Reason. That's kind of what we sounded like.
Nice. Yeah, we would come across those bands for whatever reason, like Chicago was anytime like Cursive or even the White Octave would make it out to Chicago, like it was either Jay June or Texas is the Reason or the Get Up Kids. Like we always got on these great shows. So there's always like tons of kids. We played this club called the Fireside Bowl.
I don't know if you've ever heard
of that. Yeah, it was like an old bowling alley. And it was just an absolute blast to play there. Yeah, I know. I remember seeing all those bands.
Yeah, that late '90s time was fun. Before the internet took hold, and it was, you know, a little bit again
all the mystery.
When I saw your band at the Cradle, I had never, like, I maybe have listened to the record, but I still was like,
right.
I don't know what you look like. I don't know what you're gonna do. Like there was, the unknown had me stand there instead of being like, well, you know what, they're gonna do two songs off this one and they're not gonna do that. Like I don't want to know all that.
You're absolutely right. I had the same I feel the same way about social media, the internet, and reunions.
What's your thoughts on reunions?
I know you want Tom, I'm glad you asked. The reunion, I think the high school reunion has been killed. Not that I have any particular fascination with the high school reunion, but I went to my like, I don't know, 20th or 25th. It's been a while. High school reunion. And it was like me and two other guys. And it was, you know, we were a class of like 300 and there's like three dudes there.
Oh no.
And it's because everyone knows what it's up to. Like, the thing you do at the reunion is you have like the superficial conversation where you catch up on like, what are you doing for a living? Are you married? Like what's going on in your life? And all you need to do is go to LinkedIn and Facebook and boom, you're golden.
Right.
Like, if you're more curious about someone, you can find out about them.
So you think that's the downfall of reunions, the internet?
I think the internet is, at least at all boys high schools. Maybe it's a little different at co-ed schools. Maybe there's a little more curiosity there, but I think for a bunch of dudes who went to a prep school, like all they want to know is what job do you have and is your wife good looking is probably all they care about.
And are we going to the bar after this?
Right, exactly. They were probably already at the bar. I was the fool who was like, oh yeah, I'll go and say hello to people. I'll actually talk to humans.
Yeah, you're right. No. The last reunion I went to for my high school was before the internet took hold, and we got shut down by the cops, which I thought was a pretty good.
Nice.
That is a good end. Sign. Yeah, that's a great sign.
Yeah, as long as no one got hurt. That's good.
But you were courted by some major labels with Criteria, correct?
Yes.
What was that like? And what was that? Was that before 2005?
Yes, it was super flattering and exciting and cool and, bizarre. So our first show, we had someone from, I think Atlantic or Capitol. It was Capitol Records. Someone from Capitol Records showed up to our first show ever as a live band. We had made the record. It was our CD release show was our first show. And cause I kind of put the band together after I made the record and, what was her name? Laurel Stearns, maybe? Is that her name? Anyway. So yeah, there was like Capitol and, a Geffen imprint called, I think, Strutter or something like that. Will Langolf was his name. Who else? I think RCA. I mean, none of it ever materialized, and understandably so. But it was very entertaining and flattering and just kind of a great distraction.
I bet. So they came to Omaha.
Omaha, that's right. Yeah, and I think we were maybe going to – I think someone wanted to fly us out to, like, play a showcase, like, where you just go and, like – you just go to a practice space or a club during the day and just, like, play for the record label people.
Yeah, yeah. The staff will come out at lunchtime. Yeah.
Yeah. We did not do that. But we did have people come to, like, we were pretty active back then. So we'd have, anytime we played New York, there would be label people there that would say hello. And, so yeah, that was kind of cool. And part of me was like, at the time I kind of rationalized it as, yeah, it makes sense. Like we're kind of the Saddle Creek was really hot. Like Saddle Creek was a really like big deal, back then. And I think probably some folks viewed, Criteria is probably the more a fairly accessible band.
Totally,
you know, we're not. You know, I'm not like spitting out blood at the concerts and saying evil things in my lyrics. And they're fairly catchy songs.
Yeah, so. It's straightforward. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I mean, it made sense to me that there would be some interest just because of all that was going on with Bright Eyes and Cursive and the Faint at the time, that we were kind of an unattached band. We didn't really have at the time a big label like Saddle Creek had not stepped up to put out any of the records. So yeah, it was kind of fun.
Yeah, it's weird. I work at labels, and so it's always weird to see the bands come in, you know, when they have to do a showcase or we're doing those things. Yeah. I just look at them, I'm like, I'm so sorry.
even at the time I was like, wow, this is completely artificial. Like there's just I don't know how you really assess. I mean, I guess you can assess a band that way, but it just seemed a little demeaning. I don't know.
Like see it in the town that you're big in or see it in the town with other bands. Don't like this artificial like performance. Like what's you heard the song. What's the, I don't know. It seems.
Right. And for me, it was like, hey man, if you really like the band, just come see us.
Yeah.
Just, you know, come out on our terms. not your terms.
No.
If you're really interested. So, and that was, to me, that was a clear indication that the interest was not probably strong enough to warrant going to a label where you just would be one of, you know, 40 bands and kind of get lost in the shuffle.
40? You tried hundreds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just, but hit the point home even harder. I mean, we just would have been completely lost in the shuffle. And around that same time, Brit from Spoon was going through, you know, they had put out a series of sneaks on a major label, and it was kind of a disaster for them. That was like kind of very fresh in Omaha's mind of like, man, major labels can really screw your band up. Now everything turned out fine for Spoon. But at the time, like, people were like, damn, that label totally screwed them over, like held up their record, mm-hmm. then wouldn't release them from the contract. And it was just kind of a nightmare for them. So I didn't want a nightmare. Or even the small possibility of one.
Right. And then Saddle Creek released When We Break in 05.
Yeah.
And it has the jam.
Which is?
Prevent the World.
Oh, yeah. Right. Right. Yes, of course.
And there's a video.
Yeah, we did a video. Yep, that was the tune.
What did it feel like to take a swing at that song at that year? Like, do you remember anything about it? Like, did you feel?
Sure, man. I felt like a caged tiger. You know, I really wanted to play music full time.
Yeah.
And was trying to figure out how can I make that happen as someone who just spent, you know, $140,000 on law school and had a really good job and otherwise very content in my life. How do I justify leaving all that to play music? Mm-hmm. And just being really frustrated by that. But also, you know, there was some sweetness in all of the upper class tragedy of my life. Like, I was self-aware enough to know that, like, no one should be feeling sorry for me. I am a very lucky boy. So, there's hopefully enough winking, in the song that there's some irony, and some, I don't take it too seriously, but yeah, at the time I was naming the album When We Break, like, not if,
mm-hmm.
when, and you know, it had a couple different meanings obviously, but one of those meanings was, you know, when the band breaks, like when we get big, like when we break. So, I mean, there was an effort to sort of, write that into my reality and make it real.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked for a little while. I mean, I took about 2.5 years off of work, to just play music. And it was a great, incredible experience to get to do that. So yeah, it was a great adventure.
With that record and that swing, I was at Equal Vision at the time, and we were, you know, trying to break records, and we were trying to get videos on Fuse, or you know, there was the you know, obviously the MTV2 was actually still playing, you know,
dude,
records.
Who was on Equal Vision?
Then?
Yes.
Armor for Sleep, Fall of Troy, Circa Survive, Chiodos, okay. Snake Across the Crown. Who else was around?
Yeah. Yeah, dude. We did a 7-week tour with Fall of Troy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, dude. We opened, so it was, who was it? It was Fall of Troy, Horse the Band.
Yes.
Criteria, and Poison the Well.
Poison the Well opened?
No, they were the headliners.
Okay, I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah. We all opened for Poison the Well, and Fall of Troy went over great. So did Horse the Band. Criteria, not as much. But it was an absolute wild, oh my God, the Fall of Troy guys. I mean, I don't know what they're up to now, but they were absolute hellraisers back then. I mean, they were very young. I think the guitar player was maybe 19. They destroyed every night. Like, they were a absolutely frenetic and kinetic band, but, yeah, that was, uh, it was, That was an intense 7 weeks.
Oh my God. Horse the Band and Fall of Troy. Like, that's enough. And then yes. It's like Poison the Well. Like, oh my
yes.
God.
Yes. All of that. Yeah.
Do you know the.
Cool. You worked at that label. I've always told Matty McGinn anytime he talks to me about like publishing criteria stuff, because he's kind of helped out with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, our sweet spot is foreign made pickup trucks. Like Honda, like Honda trucks should use Criteria songs. Like they should use Criteria songs in their commercials. That's our sweet spot. Foreign made pickup trucks. And Honda, not even Toyota. Toyota's too, the Ram is too American. It's too country.
Right.
But the Honda, I don't know if
the Honda Ridgeline
pickup truck anymore. Right. That Criteria songs can totally sell Honda pickup trucks.
What about the Tesla one? Are you going to do the Cybertruck? I think it would fit the Cybertruck.
Dude, the Cybertruck would not fit in my garage. I have a very tiny garage. My brother actually just ordered a Tesla Model S last week. So I'm excited to, I am surrounded by threes. My neighbor across the street and the neighbor behind me both have Model 3s and they love them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. See what we got? But I think we should petition the Cybertruck marketing to find a Criteria song.
I would not stop you. That's not a bad idea. We could put Prevent the World on that advertisement.
Right. It's still a song. It's still around.
It is. Still available for all your sinking needs.
Well, I wanted to get a couple things and then talk about the new record. One thing was the producing records. And I think with you making music, performing a bunch of instruments, like having that knack, what itch, whatever, for you versus your own music?
Oh, so, I don't even know, dude. I think the reason people asked me to produce the records is because I had the recording equipment.
Really?
And it was kind of like, well, Steve has a Pro Tools HD1 system and some microphones and some nice mic preamps and a house. Let's see if he'll record it. So I think it was less about the Steve, at least for most of them. Now, maybe, do you know Jonah? Do you know Jonah Bear?
Yes, of course. I was just texting with him today.
Oh my God. Oh, he's such a sweet man. So I think the Love Kill genuinely thought that I was going to be a producer.
Interesting.
And I feel like I almost kind of delivered on it. But that's probably the closest I've come to really being like being involved, not in just sort of letting someone use my recording equipment, but like, coming up with ideas for songs and,
do you like that?
Really kind of, yeah, I loved it. It was great. Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think of a good way to explain it. So part of it is definitely like chess player, chess piece. Like I like being the chess piece, and learning how all the different pieces move.
Mm-hmm.
So I can be the chess player. Like chess player is a thing that's really cool because then you kind of, you can kind of control the board and predict movement and sort of orchestrate, all these different things based upon sort of these sets of rules. So for me, being the producer was like being the chess player, and understanding how all the pieces move and work together and, orchestrating it in a way that is, rock optimal.
And do you think your lawyer background helps navigate the tough conversations?
Oh, I don't know. Actually probably maybe a little bit. I mean, I think it's probably more, what I got from my mother, who is, she is not a lawyer. My dad is a lawyer. But my mom was always very good at relating, and she could just relate with anyone.
Wow.
And just hold a conversation and ask good questions and really be interesting and interested in others. And
present.
Yeah. And I like to think that's a quality that I got from her. When you catch me on a good day. So, you know, just showing a little bit of interest in others and wanting to understand them goes a long way, especially when you're trying to convince them of something.
Right.
That you've kind of built up that rapport and
you've listened
and some credibility. Yeah.
So 15 years, you're going to have a new Criteria record.
Why not?
Why not? You're going to open up the cursive tour. So that means you're quitting your job again or you got some PTO?
No, I'm going to work from the road as much as I can.
Nice.
And then when I have days that, I am not productive, I will put in for PTO. But my boss, the CEO of this company is also a musician. And plays bass in a band called Clarence Tilton, who actually a really good band here in Omaha. And so he gets it, you know, he's actually excited for me. Obviously he wants to be sure that I can still sort of perform some basic functions while I'm away. But he's like genuinely excited, and is probably going to come out. We've got offices in Denver and in San Diego. So I think he's probably going to come out for a couple of the shows and hang out, and yeah. So I'm super lucky, man. I got a company that is supportive of this adventure. So it's really cool.
And so when did the music start? When did you feel like this was going to start up again?
Wow. A long time ago. We tracked the drums for this record. So this record was built. And by that I mean, we weren't all in a room together playing the songs live.
Mm-hmm.
Just by the nature of our lives and my life in particular, just being able to take that much time to make a record just wasn't in the cards. So we tracked the drums in January of 2014.
Wow.
and then I built the songs around those original drum lines, and some of them evolved pretty dramatically, others not so much. But just kind of I've got three kids and I've had some fairly intense professional stretches, and I'm married. And try to have a good, healthy relationship with my wife, Emily. So music was not always or even often the priority. Mm-hmm. There were just other things that were more important and still are. So I just had to find time. And finding time to like get into a creative space was really hard to do. So it just took a long time. But stuck with it. And I'm super excited for people to hear it.
I mean, I think life goes through those where you were busy with your job or you had your kids or, you know, there were things you're going on in your life, and to be able to keep doing it and be able to have these songs essentially stay alive. I mean, if you recorded part of it in 2014, they've been alive and you're able to get them out and then be able to share them with people is pretty magical.
Yeah. It is super magical, dude. Like I feel really lucky to be, to have the record coming out and to be able to go out on tour and perform it, and to play, Prevent the World every night, as well as the coincidence of me on your front porch, is going to be super, it's just going to be super cool. I'm really excited. And, very keen to deliver every night.
Nice. So the first song is Agitate Resuscitate. That's the first song that's mm-hmm. out. And this bad boy's out January 17th.
It is. It's happening. It's imminent.
All right. A few more. What do you want to do that you haven't done? This could be anything.
What do I want to do that I haven't done? God, God, man. I mean, the last thing I really wanted to do was to make a third record. I'd never made a third record with a band before.
Wow, you're right.
I've always made two records, like in every band I've been in. It's always been two. So I really wanted to make a third record and was, even though it took a long time, was very focused on getting that done. And so I'm just kind of smelling the roses right now, man. I'm smelling the flowers. Like, it feels good to have gotten that done. I don't have any big grand desires right now other than to just go on tour and rock extremely hard every night.
Love it.
Yeah, man.
Cool.
I'm excited. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, man. Thank you a ton for the interest and for taking the time.